I am Plata of the Line in Vancouver, British Columbia, at thecommentary.ca. Nina Montiano joins me again. She's just published a new novel, A Diary in the Age of Water. The noted writer and limnologist, a freshwater scientist, has written a book that could be considered science fiction. I suppose cli-fi is the better term, climate-based science fiction. In the book, Far Away in a Post-Climate Change World, Kyo finds a diary that gives her insight into the world before water scarcity. I'll get Nina to tell us about Kyo, about the themes in this book, especially the world ahead if we continue as we do. Nina Montiano is an author and ecologist. She has published many books of science fiction and fantasy and was first on the program in 2016 when her book Water Is, The Meaning of Water, was published. The website for more is at ninamontiano.ca. This new book is from Inanna Publications. Please welcome back to the Plant Outline program, Nina Montiano. Ms. Montiano, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us.
Pleasure's mine.
I probably have asked you this before, but I'll ask it anyway. Were you always interested in water, even as a kid, say?
I was. But you know, it's funny, when I was a kid, I may have said this before in an interview, too, I should check. I was actually scared of water, so yeah. I was interested in that regard, but I turned that, you know, I couldn't swim, I wasn't a strong swimmer. My brother and sister would play out there and do things, and I would just go and study it. So I turned that fear into fascination, and my career followed after that.
And did the fascination, did that, say, eliminate the fear?
No. You never eliminate, well, maybe you do eliminate a fear. Well, you know, I became an avid boater. My husband had a boat, and families had boats, and I, of course, as a limnologist, uh-huh. I had to go on boats and do studies, and I'd be in my own boat, rowboat or motorboat, so I had to run motors and run boats all by myself, and so in a sense, I did overcome that fear, but there's always a healthy respect for water.
Yeah.
But in studying water, I became so fascinated by its properties, and very soon that really overtook any fear. So it's more like a healthy respect than a fear.
So in the novel, A Diary in the Age of Water, Kyo, that's how you pronounce her name, right? Kyo?
Pardon?
Kyo, is
yes.
that? That's how yes. you pronounce her name, yeah. She's fascinated with the water, too, isn't she?
She is, and in some ways, she's very much a water creature. I mean, I have that kind of tenet behind the entire book that we are all made of water. We're, you know, over 70% water.
Yeah.
And water is almost like a silent character in this book, particularly in that it speaks to each of the characters a little bit differently. The book is basically the journey of four generations of women.
Uh-huh.
And their unique relationship with water during a time of extreme change. It's climate change, right, and water yeah. shortage. So their relationship with water, the water speaks through them, through their relationships with water. And Kyo, who is the last character, the one who actually discovers the diary, she's in the far future.
Uh-huh.
She has a very different relationship to water, in fact, to the point where she is, in some ways, a water being. So it's more than fascination. It's sort of living water.
Yeah, definitely. And what is the world that we find her in? What does it look like, say?
She is in a northern part of Canada. We find out that in Canada, it isn't any longer. It's sort of the boreal forest that has somewhat transformed into something else through climate change, climate warming.
Uh-huh.
And it's now turning into more of a lush jungle, which is essentially what happens, right? All the trees move north. They're migrating right now. I mean, the maple tree is migrating north as we speak at a very slow rate, but that's what's happening. So the environment has changed according to climate change itself. And she's in this forest trying to imagine what the age of water looked like, what this place was like before.
Yeah. And you've written a number of books in the realm of science fiction. This book really is, it's not too far-fetched, is it, in terms of I mean, if we continue the way we're headed, say, with regards to how we view the environment, climate change, this is what it'll be, right?
Definitely. Well, it's one stream, it's one thought.
Yeah.
Most of the book, well, this part, you know, the part that has Keo in it is in the far future. It's the projected projected version of what could happen, what mm-hmm. might happen, from a scientist's point of view. The lion's share of the book is actually the diary, which takes place pretty much right now. It takes place from 2020.
Yeah.
It even includes the current pandemic
mm-hmm.
into the 2060s, so a 40-year span of time, near future. And it's in the form of a diary, and the diary itself is by the limnologist, who then chronicles real things. So a lot of what's in the diary is straight from reality. So that part of the book mixes real and fictional.
Yeah.
To such a point where some people won't know the difference, and I did that on purpose to provide a kind of gritty reality to the book, and I chose the diary for that purpose as well. So it then serves as a good adjunct or a place to jump off into the potential future that I then paint in the very beginning and the very end of the book with the character.
Without giving too much away, does Keo judge how, say, this generation has handled the world as it is?
Does she judge it?
Yeah.
That's a really cool question. I guess she does. But what's interesting is after she reads the diary and after she has some information about the previous age from her mentors. She's a young acolyte, actually, who's preparing for the exodus of humanity, actually,
uh-huh.
from the planet. And she's meant to go to the library to learn more about that time period. And she has already some preconceived notions about what it was like and who perpetrated what. And there's this pair of women called the Water Twins who presumably created great devastation. And she has preconceived ideas of what they did, who they are. And then after reading the diary, she has different ideas, and then she speaks with her mentor again and has yet again and is basically corrected in her perceptions. So, yes, she has quite a judgment, but it shifts and turns according to the information that she's presented with.
I guess the thing that's fascinating about reading about your book and reading the little bit that I have, I forget the what's that line in the rear view mirror, objects are closer than they actually appear. This stuff, that's what worries a lot of people. I'm sure it worries you that this is not too far-fetched, if you will.
You're very right, Joseph. I mean, it had its root. This is, you know, this is eco-fiction. It's science fiction, but it's a cautionary tale.
Yeah.
And most cautionary tales, like Margaret Atwood is very well known for hers, with Handmaid's Tale and her Mad Adam trilogy,
mm-hmm.
is very much based on reality. And because of that, its projections are rightfully so quite scary, because they could, in fact, happen. And in some ways, the only question really is when, not what. And the whole concept, I mean, the reality of climate change is that it is here with us. It's occurring. Anyone who has, I shouldn't say it, half a brain,
mm-hmm.
will understand what's happening, that it's a climate phenomenon, and that each region is already witnessing its own unique form of what's going on with the climate, with climate warming. And we're part of it. It's like we're on a wave. And there are certain things that aren't happening, certain things that are happening that are, you know, are helping or not helping or hindering, as you can imagine, political forces and capitalist forces and, you know, corporations not willing to do this and that and people just not understanding, that isn't, I guess, not giving us the tools which are out there to, or the wherewithal to do something. And that's frustrating for people like myself who are scientists who understand what's going on.
Yeah.
And so this prompts books like this. They're not meant to be, you know, proselytizing or polemic, but they're, I think they have a utility in that they show a possible future. While still entertaining you with a gripping story, which of course this is, because this story has lots of things in it that, you know, there's betrayal, it's suspense, it's forgiveness or lack of forgiveness, there's even a murder in there, and I'm not going to tell you who does what, but you know, there's things that happen in this book, and it's all translated by this person who's a diarist, and she has her own take on things, and she's not a perfect person, and she's just trying her best. And so there are no real good guys and bad guys in this. There are just shades of people trying to do their best. And of course, the misunderstandings occur, and all these types of things happen.
But the thing that I've been thinking about in preparing for a chat today is that I'm wondering how you, as a scientist, as a limnologist, now as a writer, how do you deal with that frustration day after day when you know there are people who are who might have impure motive, who might be bad, you could even say willfully ignorant, if you will, as to what they're doing now and how that imperils the future.
Yeah, that's a great question. In some ways, I'm a different person as a scientist than I am as a writer, than again as a mother. And what I do is sometimes I just get out downright angry, and that doesn't help. But what happens eventually is I draw on something that gives me strength and gives me hope. And in many cases, it comes down to my son or another particular person who gives me hope. I mean, my son is an incredible person and very hopeful. He's younger, obviously, and he, you know, the world is in front of him. And yet he still sees. He doesn't see with cloudy glasses. He sees what's going on. But he has a certain optimism about things, which I like to have, which I like to think I still have. But when I delve into these things, and in fact, when I wrote this particular book, I did go into a funk where I got really mad because I was doing research on real things. And I was in some ways discovering more than I really wanted to. That's not a good place to go because you can go down a black hole.
Right.
And the way to get out of it, the way I got out of it was I drew on one of the characters that was positive and would lead me out of that into a place of hope, into a place of greater hope for the greater humanity. And I think that's the key, is there's always going to be people like you mentioned, right, who don't see things right, who never do, who are nasty, who are downright evil, maybe.
Yeah.
But there are so many that are the opposite of that. And so it's a question of your viewpoint and shifting it and going with that. And it's really about motion and very much like water itself moves, right?
Yeah.
And it's drawing in some ways on the water energy of flow. And flowing out of that, I remember saying someone who said, if you find yourself in hell, keep moving. and in a way, that's what it is, right?
Yeah,
and the writers, all good, do this. They put themselves in that hell, no matter what it is. In this case, you know, a lot of my books are about climate change and environmental disasters. And then you get yourself out of there. You find a way out, and that makes for a compelling story. It also makes for something that's inspirational, something that readers like. So it's still dystopia, but it pulls you out of there. And it's not that it takes you out of dystopia necessarily, but it shows the strength of people who are in it that there is hope for them. And there is a lot of what's called mundane science fiction that's emerging that is dealing with just that kind of subject matter. Paolo Bacigalupi's Wind-Up Girl is a good example of he places you in a dystopia, and in his characters, it's what his characters do that moves them through, that allows the reader to gain some hope, even if the world is kind of crappy.
Yeah.
But mine goes a step further. Mine does go, without giving too many spoilers, it does move beyond that, so it's quite hopeful, actually.
And it's an inspiring thing to hear you talk about, literally writing yourself out of despair, when you know there is so much that is around us that is not encouraging, if you will.
And maybe Joseph, maybe that's why I write, because it gives me a medium to get myself out of there, because I think the worst place to be is in a place where you feel helpless, where you're not able to do anything about something. As long as, and again, it goes back to my metaphor of water, if you're able to flow, you know, water doesn't like to be held back, and, you know, it goes stagnant in a pond. Water really wants to move. And when it moves, literally, I'm going to use the word, it's literally happy.
Yeah.
You know, it burbles and gurgles and makes wonderful sounds, and we need to do that too. If we're in motion, then we can handle so much more. It's when we're stuck that the smallest thing can really get us down and, you know, create that big hole that we'll never get out of. So as long as we're moving, doing something directed, have our sights set beyond, then we'll be okay. I think stories, and stories like this one, help provide that, help provide, you know, a million different directions that people can go. It's just one of them.
One of the things that I've been thinking about as we've been chatting, Nina, is this idea of water scarcity. That's not something we've been thinking much about living in Canada, because we're surrounded by water, and we think that it could never happen here. But it could, couldn't it?
It certainly could, and it's because water scarcity is more political than anything else. I mean, the same amount of water has been on the planet since the dinosaurs roamed.
Right.
And that, you know, that's an eye-opener right there. So it's not that there's much less water around. It's that a lot of the water is polluted, some of it is inaccessible, and then the rest is hoarded in one way or moved and diverted to create elsewhere, and it's the movement of water, it's where the water is, that's creating that perception of scarcity. So move into a place like Canada, which has an abundant water. What's happening with it? We're giving it away.
Yeah.
We're mining the groundwater, and we're creating our own drought right here in a water-rich country. And depending on, you know, what else we're doing with it, things can happen. So we need to look only a little bit further south to Detroit, for instance, where people's taps were shut, right? Because they weren't paying water tax. And they were thirsting for water, and there was a problem with that, a huge problem. They were starving for water. In other states, in other places in America, some states actually forbid private citizens from actually collecting rainwater. And this is because they have determined that that rainwater doesn't belong to them. So these are you know, it's not and those are areas usually where there's water scarcity, right?
Yeah.
So what they're doing is they're trying to manage that, where that water is going, and they're trying to keep people from hoarding, but at the same time, they're removing a person's right to access water over someone else. And so this whole politicization starts to happen with water. Who gets what and who manages it? So it then goes to the utilities.
Mm-hmm.
And the utilities are, many of them operate, they're private utilities, so they operate on a profit. So because of that, that creates this whole accessibility problem. Who gets what, right?
Yeah.
Can you afford it? You know, and water shouldn't, honestly, water is a God-given right to all life and gives life to all life. If you put a dollar sign on it, if you commodify it, I think there's some real problems with that, because that then creates a disparity with the ability to access it.
And I'm reminded that there are still, you know, reserves in this country, native
reserves.
Well,
there certainly are.
Yeah, that do not have access to water, and that's obviously a political issue.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. That is political, very political, and it shouldn't be the case, right?
Indeed.
It's one of the largest ironies of our country, really.
Yeah.
Is that we have such a water-rich country, and there are many of them on the reserves who don't have access to clean water.
Yeah.
And there are many reasons for that, and those are also equally atrocious.
Indeed.
We could go into that topic quite a bit, but, you know, as it turns out, it's all related. It's all related to the political scenario and right people and respect for water and life and all those kind of things. It's part of a much larger thing that's going on. I do touch upon that in the book, but it's more subtle.
I want to end on this, Nina. I've asked you this before. We know too many people who around us, myself included, who rely on water bottles a lot, plastic water bottles, that is. Why shouldn't we, say, use or buy water in bottles?
Right.
Especially in this country.
Yeah. You say that rightly, especially in this country. It's mostly an optics thing. There's two main reasons. The first reason is how that water is taken currently.
Uh-huh.
It's not taken very nicely. So it's large companies, and you can imagine which ones I mean.
Right.
Two or three main ones.
Yep.
One main one. And the way that they take the water is like I mentioned, they basically get it for next to nothing. And what they do is they're depleting the aquifer and the watershed that belongs to a community. So they're stealing, essentially, water from a community and then selling it abroad. And a lot of this is sold abroad elsewhere. So they're stealing, literally stealing water and moving it across. They're like smugglers.
Mm-hmm.
So that's, to me, that's the whole process is not great, right? There's something wrong with that. Secondly, the whole concept of drinking bottled water engenders a way of thinking that, oh, our natural water isn't good enough. We have to go buy it.
Yeah.
It's not necessarily the main reason that people do that. I think people buy bottled water because it's convenient. They can just go get it and drink it.
Sure, yeah.
But funnily enough, that's come with a few other things that have happened. Where in any public area do you see water fountains anymore? There used to be water fountains everywhere.
Right.
In schools, and they're reintroducing them, by the way, in schools, and they're taking bottled water away. So they used to have them available, and now they don't.
Yeah.
Kids, I think, can still buy Coke or something.
Yeah.
But if they want water, they can go to the water fountain. So what it does is it promotes the idea that water is commodifiable. That's the other thing, that you pay for water. Water, in truth, should be free.
Yeah.
In fact, it's not in most places, right? We pay pay for water in our households, and we have taxes that basically pay for the water utility. So it's not exactly free, but it's like socialized medicine. It should be available, equally available to all people. And it's that whole concept of water being available to us that is necessary. So buying bottled water is basically supporting the idea that water is for sale as opposed to water is free to a society.
And I think that's a point worth making. I know I asked you this before, but I wanted it brought up again because I'm by no means perfect. I occasionally find myself having to do that,
and
I think it's a good reminder as to why we shouldn't. So I appreciate you indulging me in that,
pleasure. It's something that I keep thinking about. The last reason for it, by the way, is simply the plastic pollution.
Indeed.
That's created because so many people litter, and or even if they put it in the garbage or in recycling, and that's a whole other story.
Uh-huh.
We have no exact evidence that all our recycling is actually recycled.
Right.
A lot of it isn't. A lot of it used to go to China, and then China said, no, we don't want your stuff. So then it ended up going to various places in Indonesia. And what did they do? They didn't have the facilities to handle everything, so it ended up in the rivers. And then from the rivers, it ended up in Plastic Island, in the Pacific, which is about the size of France or something.
Yeah.
And so it's still, the source is still us, right?
Yeah.
And it's just that it takes a different route. But so there are many reasons and many fronts where not buying bottled water represents so many things that you can do. So you're essentially by not doing one thing, you're helping on a number of fronts, which is kind of cool.
Indeed. Nina, it's nice to talk again. Continued good luck with this book. I appreciate your time today.
Well, thank you very much. It was a pleasure.
The book is called A Diary in the Age of Water. It is published by Inanna Publications. Visit ninamontiano.ca for more. Nina Montiano joined me on the line from Peterborough, Ontario, in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Planta.